Good evening, everyone. We are excited to be hosting this very practical and informative webinar targeted toward those wishing to open a practice. We have a fantastic lineup of panelists who've agreed to share the knowledge they have gained from opening their own practices. It is our hope that you gain some valuable insight as you plan your own dream practice.
We'll take a moment to introduce ourselves. We are Jeff and Tina Goodhue. We own a private practice in Oakville, Ontario, which we began 12 years ago. We have started three practices throughout our careers. Obviously, we are slow learners and it took us a while to get it right. We created this webinar to help those wanting to start a practice think through the process and hear what their colleagues have done well and what pitfalls to avoid.
Just a quick housekeeping note, a recording of this webinar will be made available on Wednesday, October 18th, and it will be posted at icarebusiness.ca.
A big thank you to our webinar sponsors for making tonight's event possible. I will introduce each sponsor by name, after which I will give them a moment to tell us about their companies. We'll start with Christina Ferrari from Simple Innovative Management Ideas, also known as SIMI.
I'm Christina Ferrari. I'm from Simple Innovative Management Ideas. I'm a managing partner with the firm, and we provide practice management services to optometrists based on data analytics. We help offices at all stages of their practice lifecycle, and that includes startups. So thanks for having me tonight.
Well, thank you for joining us, Christina. And Frank Carpino from Urban Spaces. Frank, can you tell us what you do for us?
Well, I own Urban Spaces, which designs and builds the modern optometry office, the new style.
Excellent. And is Howard able to join us? Is he on?
I can hear you now. Sorry, Tina.
Excellent.
I wasn't connected to your audio for a moment. Thank you for inviting me. Howard Dolman, in practice with my wife, Kim, in New Hamburg, Ontario. Kim and I did the opposite to a cold start. We purchased an existing practice when we were just fresh out of school. And I'm here as the board president of I Recommend.
Thank you, Howard. Now, each of these sponsors does exemplary work in their respective fields, and they come highly endorsed by their colleagues.
So tonight, we have four panelists at various stages of practice startup, ranging from just about to open in a couple months to 4 years in. So we have Lori Capogna from Niagara Falls, Michael Cruiser from Edmonton, Alberta, Agata Majewski from Roncesvalles, Toronto, and Ritesh Patel from Liberty Village, Toronto.
And first up, we have Lori. Lori's startup is unique in the sense that she's set up a specialty practice. Lori, can you please tell us a little bit about your new practice?
Sure. Thank you for having me tonight. So I started iWellness 2 years ago in 2015, and it's a practice that where we take a holistic approach. One of our main core value is education, and that's what everything is based around, especially about nutrition, but also lifestyle and the environment. We look at, you know, the whole, we take the patient as a whole and their lifestyle as a whole. So I opened after practicing for 18 years, actually with an ophthalmologist in a medical, more of a medical setting. And I hit a point in my life where I was 40 over 40 and thought, well, it's now or never, and took a plunge in and haven't looked back.
Excellent, Lori.
Next up, we have Michael Cruiser from Edmonton, Alberta. He is our youngest panelist, just recently graduated from the University of Waterloo. So Michael, please tell us what inspired you to start a practice so early in your career.
Hi there. Thanks for having me as well. Well, I've been interested in starting a practice now for probably 2 or 3 years. As I've written in my brief description here, it was amazing being in school and being exposed to so many different ideas in ODs on Facebook, in Canadian Optometry Group, and really felt I had the opportunity coming out of school and into practice to integrate some of the best ideas I saw when I was reading those sources and try to bring a new style or more modern approach to optometry targeted towards millennials in Edmonton. So that's a bit about what I'm hoping to do. Still not open yet.
And now we have Dr. Agata Majewski from Roncesvalles, Toronto. Agata has practiced in both the United States and Canada. And Agata, please tell us a little bit more about your situation.
Hi there. Thank you for having me on. I am in my third year of practicing here and owning this practice. I had a chance to work both corporate optometry in the U.S. and then practiced here in both a large specialty practice and then quite a few smaller clinics. And this happened sort of by luck. I saw a place that was up for lease, and it kind of went from there, and it happened quite quickly. So I find myself very lucky to be where I am.
Very good.
So finally, we have Dr. Ritesh Patel from Liberty Village, also in Toronto. Ritesh is our most seasoned and experienced startup with 4 years of practice ownership under his belt. So Ritesh, can you please say something to the audience about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again for having me, and I'm sure it's a valuable tool for everybody listening here. So thanks again for setting it up. You know, similar to Agata, I was actually practiced in the States. I went to school in the States, and once graduated, was in a private practice partnership with somebody, and decided to make my way back to Toronto, where I was in an ophthalmology setting, and finally decided, probably similar to the rest of the panelists, was that, hey, it's time for me to do my own thing. So I was fortunate enough to be able to pick up a lot of the tools along the way and be able to look up to a lot of mentors and pick their brain. And here I am 4 years later, enjoying every bit of it. So thanks again for having me.
Great. You're welcome. Thanks for joining.
Now that we've introduced the panelists, let's find out a little bit more about our audience. David, are you able to launch the first question, first poll question? Or should I move on from
there? It came up.
Oh, okay.
We put the first poll question on the screen, and we can see the results tabulating in as we speak. So once we have everybody has a chance to vote, we'll display the results after the first question. Back to you, Tina.
Okay, one of the first things you'll need to do is to consider which experts you must hire. And those are experts from bankers to lawyers to accountants and so on. I'm going to start with Ritesh and ask, which experts did you feel you had to use when opening your practice?
Yeah, this is a huge one, actually, because I'm looking back now, again, 4 years later, and reevaluating the entire process, even for myself. And what I found is that the list that we have here, I think, although it's quite extensive, I'd probably put them in a little bit of a different order. So for me, retrospectively, if I had to do it all over again, my financial planner / advisor would be one of the biggest the people that I find myself resorting to at this point in time, simply because they're the ones that kind of set the foundation in many ways to allow your structure to be put in place in terms of a way that would be kind of best for you at this point in time, but of course, long-term in terms of an exit strategy. And that's a key one to just keep in mind always as you're going through this process is, you know, ultimately you are going to exit, and I hate to get to that right from the beginning, but you have to work backwards from there and kind of realize that there's a lot of structure that needs to get put into place at a certain point in time. So I think a financial planner / advisor would be very crucial, which in turn can actually help break down the idea of an accountant and lawyers along the way as well. I think we were very fortunate at this point in time. I remember when I was opening my practice 4 years ago, reaching out to certain banks didn't have quite the gusto as ODs, as let's say dentists or MDs would in terms of if you needed a loan. However, I know this through some other banks that I've worked with at this point in time that ODs can get quite a bit of like loan at prime value, which is amazing if you actually need to go to that route and obviously borrow money to be able to build a practice. So to me, having your structure and foundation in place is a very crucial step. Fortunately enough, along the way, I was able to pick the brains of colleagues of mine, actually including Jeff here, and then be able to have the strongest type of players around me to allow me to be as successful as possible. And that included practice consultants and buying groups which I am part of, I recommend, coincidentally, and still continue to be to this day, which I think is a strong partner to kind of build from the very beginning. Your practice consultants will along the way, once you've kind of opened up, allow you to set the structure in a much more defined way as well. So I think this is a quite the extensive list, but putting them in the right order, I think, is a very crucial way that will allow you to be as successful as you possibly can be.
Thank you, Ritesh. Michael, would you have anything to add to that?
Sure, yeah. Beyond Ritesh made some great points about the value of financial planners, so I'm going to stay away from that one for now. But a lot of my recent efforts have been in terms of real estate and building, so contractors. And I've found it huge to secure a great commercial real estate broker of my own, so a tenant representative. This is valuable not only from the standpoint of identifying the best places in town, but also lease negotiations. And my lease negotiations, compared to some other colleagues who I've spoken to who've been through the same thing, were very smooth and went very well. It was great to have someone else to bounce ideas off, especially in these areas where I have absolutely no expertise whatsoever. So their services are free to you. If you are leasing your first space, they are totally free. So you should definitely take advantage of a good commercial real estate broker. Also from the lawyer end, there were many little nitty-gritty comments and things in the lease that needed to be looked at from a legal standpoint, whether they're tenable or not. So I was lucky enough to have a great lawyer who was involved from the start. And with their support, I was able to secure a great lease in Edmonton. So those two things are really indispensable on the list. There are lots of things I could say about. One other thing I'd like to maybe add is the practice and consultants and buying group point. I was involved with Kelly and Christina at CME from the start. And I really appreciated having at the very high level some insight from a practice consultant firm, because there are so many decisions that go into building a practice, and it's the really big ones that sometimes need to be bounced off someone else who's an expert in the field before getting started. So that's pretty much all I'll say, but this is a great list you've compiled here.
Excellent. Now, Michael, do you mind me asking, was it difficult for you to get your financing in place? Did you have to go to the bank?
I went to the bank, and it was not difficult to get financing in place.
Excellent. Just one tip that we have, and that is to make sure that, or to try to make sure that the experts that you deal with have some experience in the field of optometry. And the reason I say this is, in the very beginning, when Jeff and I opened our first practice, we had difficulty getting a bank loan. And that was until we met with a banker who had dealt with several optometrists and understood how sound the practice of optometry was. So it was difficult to get someone to take us on at first because they thought we were much more high risk than we actually were. All right, let's turn to poll number two and see which of the following experts do our audience think provide the greatest value? All right.
Okay, so I think we'll move on to the next slide. So just like the header says, location, 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 this is arguably the most important of your decisions that you can, or one of the most important decisions that it can make or break the success of your practice. So again, because this is very near and dear to you, Michael, as far as timing goes, what type of research did you do in finding your location in Edmonton?
Well, it's an interesting and complicated question, because I had two other bids on places before finally determining my end location in the city. Key things to me were a demographic that had a lot of growth and a lot of younger people moving to it. So my current location is on a retail street where it, over the past 5 to 10 years, has experienced tremendous growth in terms of high-density buildings. And also this area is underrepresented in terms of optometrists in the city. So I think that those were two key factors. What I was going earlier about the commercial real estate broker, and if you find a good commercial real estate broker, they should be able to help you with identifying key market demographics. My broker, for instance, had sent me locations of other optometrists in the city and 1 kilometer radius distance to 5 kilometer radius distances away from them. And based on that information, you can sort of piece together a decent spot that you can stake for your own. Another important factor in the location is price. And in these high density urban areas in Edmonton, there is a pretty big fluctuation in terms of the asking price per square foot. One key piece of information I got from my advisors was to keep in mind that a huge cost that you can control up front is your overhead. So that's the cost per square foot. And being aware of that and not overspending on your real estate is a great way to get started on the right foot.
I like what you said about your broker. I mean, your broker obviously went above and beyond by... So you're saying the broker was the one that sort of mapped out where the competition was, not yourself.
Well, I mean, I was aware of the competition, but he definitely went above and beyond. And that prevent, you know, with that information, it allowed me to focus my energy in other aspects of looking at places. So that's the benefit of having a great team from the start, is that you can piggyback off of the services of other professionals who are way better at this, you know, than when you're starting and you have your hand in so many different pots.
Yes.
It was a really big help.
Right. Great. So maybe we'll head back east here into Niagara Falls. So Lori, how did you choose where to open your practice back in 2015?
Well, Niagara Falls isn't all that large of a city. So I thought about using a real estate broker, but in the end, I didn't. I ended up myself just kind of driving around, finding every vacant building that was available. And I had a bit of, you know, I had a bit of a dilemma. At first, I really wanted to buy a building. I thought I'd never leased before. I'd always owned the building I was working out of. So when I saw there really wasn't anything available, then I started looking into plazas. And I looked at the new ones and the older ones. And based on what was available, I actually just took something that I liked the location because it was in the same plaza as a Shoppers Drug Mart. It actually used to be an old LCBO, which they then moved across the street. For those not from Ontario, that's the liquor store. And it actually proved to be very, very a good decision because I can't tell you how many patients come in and say, I love your location and I see you here all the time and I'm in this plaza all the time. So that was kind of my story with that. But I was reluctant. I didn't realize the benefit to being in a retail location because I'd always been in a medical building before.
Great. Agata, you opened in a highly competitive neighborhood in Toronto. What did you look for when you opened your practice?
So just like you were saying, in the city, it's very hard, I think, to find a place where, you know, you don't have an optometrist next door. My location is at street level in a neighborhood that's very family friendly. There's 4 or 5 schools surrounding me. So, and there's been quite an influx of families to this neighborhood, which I knew. So I knew the area I wanted to be in, and I was driving by, like Lori said, and I saw the space for lease, which was an old sort of variety shop. So it's a small space, but it's street level. And most of our patients are, I didn't have to advertise, they were just coming in off the street. So as it says, location, location, that has probably been the most valuable place in terms of opening the practice.
Okay, great. So a question to the group, and if whoever wants to take this question, go ahead and just shout out, but can any of you comment on opening a new practice in a medical building versus a sort of street level traditional retail location? Does anyone have an experience around that?
Maybe I can speak to it. Ritesh Patel again. You know, I think there's been an or. You have to be in the mindset of, well, you have to choose, let's say, a medical building versus a, let's say, retail setting. What we did was, when we were actually going through the process of where we want to open, we created a matrix, and the matrix was consistent of maybe the four or five things that was most valuable to us. And one of those things that were on that list was being around family physicians and practitioners, because at least in Ontario, and this might be different in every province, but in Ontario, it's, you know, you can consider them a feeder system to allow for that just to have patients come through the door, you know, whether it happens to be diabetics or red eye or annual exams or children, whatever it may be. You know, I think keeping that in consideration would be a pretty massive practice builder. It just allows you to continue to grow. And in our case, we are retail setting. We are ground floor. We're in a relatively high traffic area. But we also happen to be in the same building as about 12 to 15 other family physicians as well. You don't have to necessarily have to choose one versus the other. I think, you know, if you have the right location, as Michael said, and you have the right research around you, you very well might be able to get both. And, you know, most of us want to have our cake and eat it too. And I think that's hopefully a good way to kind of look at it as well.
Anyone else have any comments on that before we go on?
Jeff, I have just one quick thing to add. It's Howard Dolman. Sure. You know, we're in a very rural setting, a small community, and most of our patients, if not, the vast majority, do drive to our clinic. And so, you know, the amount of parking that you have in a rural setting is important, you know, as opposed to being in a, you know, an urban setting where being closer to, you know, transit and having easy access for your patients to get to you. So that's certainly one consideration to think of in terms of location.
Great point. Now, just a few tips. As Michael had alluded to before, you can certainly check with your broker for information. But if you're in the process of still just trying to look at an area and you don't have a broker yet, you can also check with City Hall, and they often have plans on what their growth and demographics of a neighborhood is. One of the other tips we give you is to plot your competition, which was alluded to previously. And the final thought I have there is that even the location within your location is extremely important. And what I mean by that is we are in a mall that we've been in for 12 years, but for 10 of those years, we were at one side of the strip. And 2 years ago, we renovated and expanded, and we moved to the center of the strip that happens to be in front of one of the entrances, drive-in entrances. And we found that our traffic has jumped significantly, with people saying that they, you know, didn't know that we were in the mall previously, even though we'd been there for 10 years. So again, location within the location is very key as well.
Okay.
So perhaps the most exciting and stressful part of the process is the designing and building of your practice. Once you've chosen your location, you'll need to design your practice and you'll need to choose a builder. Frank from Urban Spaces is going to help guide us through this process. So Frank, what are the things to consider with regards to choosing a contractor? So for example, if I wanted to find someone to as a contractor, what things should I look for in that contractor?
Well, you'd start off maybe doing some searches, whether online or through friends, to see if they've who they've used and how things have panned out for them. If you manage to find or hear someone that is reputable, you may also want to ask if he's done any optometric practices, because it is there is a certain knack in building optometry offices, depending on who they're designed by. The contractor usually kind of can actually pinpoint or make suggestions along the way to better the whole process and the final result. You can check also online, like do a Google search, you know, see how reputable they are, if there's anything that's that pops up saying, you know, stay away from this guy, or everything works well with them. You give a, you know, 4-star rating, 5-star rating.
Do you think it's worthwhile getting bids from different contractors? And if so, how many would you suggest?
Everyone says 3, but realistically, you know, if you can get 5, 6, 7, you know, as many people as you want, because you actually get a feel. of what is realistic. The more numbers you have to look at, the more you get a feel of what you're actually getting. So, and the most important thing, don't always go for the cheapest bid, because I would say 7 out of 10 times, the cheapest one will definitely come back and bite you.
Yes, and they will go over that, what they've stated.
Yes.
Frank, can you give us an idea of time frame required to set up a practice? So from the drawing to the permit to the construction phase?
Okay, now, depending on the designer, some designers can have concept drawings ready for you within a week or 2 weeks. Others may take up to a month, maybe even longer. And again, that's just for concept. Okay, people get confused when they say drawings and concept. Concept is going back and forth with the doctor and the staff to find out what works for them, what works for their staff, what works for their office flow, what works for their environment. Okay, so that is just the basic idea. After that is ironed out, then it goes to architectural, it goes to permit drawings. Now here in Ontario, okay, what I am talking about here in Ontario. Once it goes to architect, architects can take anywhere from a week to 3 weeks to prepare permit drawings. During the preparation of permit drawings, a CAD file will have to be created. Before the CAD file is created, you really can introduce a mechanical engineer, which again, in Ontario, you will need a mechanical engineer. And if you want to keep your costs in check, you would wait for the CAD file to be produced by the architect. So this way you can send that file over to your mechanical engineer and he can work off those layers to prepare mechanical drawings. Usually, again, this would also be anywhere between a week to a 3 week procedure. Okay, so now you're into this well over a month on an average to have permit drawings ready. Once you submit, here in Ontario, if again depending on size and location, they usually call say between 15 to say 20 working days to give you approvals. The chances of that happening right now in the past 7 years that we've been doing this, I'd say it's less than 30%. 70% of the time, it's more than that time, more than that time frame. I would probably allow safely a month and a half to get a permit once application's been made. But we have had situations where we got a permit in 15 working days.
Okay. And then construction. How long would you say it takes to construct? Let's go with like 1,250 square feet.
Okay. There are some variables in this. If it's just an empty shell and the contractor that you go with, designer contractor that you go with, if you're well organized, meaning that you've got all your T's crossed, your I's dotted, you know exactly what you're getting in regards to sizes, colors, materials, everything, the whole thing, and no changes are made. An office that size, I would no more than 2 months.
Okay. So realistically, we should be looking at 3+ months from the time we start the drawings to the construction phase.
3.5 months plus.
Okay. All right. Now I'm going to turn my attention to Agata. Can you tell us how you began the design process? How did you come up with the look of your practice?
I'm listening to Frank and I'm realizing that I didn't do any of the things I'm supposed to do.
Oh dear.
I started with Pinterest. I just looked up offices that I liked the look of, and a lot of it was retail based because the front part of the office is so exposed to the street. So I wanted something that A, would fit the neighborhood, B, be inviting to families and kids, and C, would go along with the aesthetic that I wanted to have. So after pulling a bunch of the Pinterest drawings, I was lucky enough that I had a architect friend who had helped design. We had to put up two or three walls in the office. It's not a big space, just to divide the rooms. So we had our drawings done and probably had permits within, like Franco was saying, about 2 weeks. I think there's a way to speed it up. So we had that set and ready to go before the contractor came in when I had my keys to the office. So really it was just a matter of picking a few colors, and then I didn't have a designer, so I sourced out everything on my own, from the receptionist desk to cabinetry to chairs. Everything was done sort of piece by piece by me and my very good friends who helped me build it.
So what time frame did it take you, Agata, to get your practice set up to open?
I received the keys to the building February 1st, and we were open mid-April, and the permits were done early December.
Excellent. Okay. And Ritesh, do you have anything to add to what Agata has said?
I actually had maybe a little bit of a gel between the two. It did take us about 4 months for us to go from start to finish, including permits and so forth. But very much like Agata, I did a combination of Pinterest and just kind of getting a feel of what I wanted. And what was, I think what the key thing is just being authentic to your neighborhood, authentic to yourself. You know, it's nice to be able to go into, let's say, whether it's retail or anything, any other type of setting. It's like, hey, this feels amazing. But you also have to walk through these doors 5, 6, 7 days a week, and you have to kind of put yourself in the position of your patients as well. We did have a designer help us for certain parts of it, and similar to finding out what type of contractor would be ideal for you, for designers, you may go through 3, 4, or 5 different type of designs until you actually get the right feel of what fits ideally for you and your neighborhood. If you are in a retail setting, let's say ground floor, that may have a different feel than you would be if you were just strictly in the medical setting. So keeping that in mind as well in terms of what's authentic to you and what's authentic to your neighborhood, I think would be really crucial.
Excellent. One other tip I might give, which I'm sure everyone does anyways, is just to visit a bunch of your colleagues. And some of the best information you can get is just asking them what they wish they could change about their office and what they think works great about their office.
Okay, so here's an example that we came up with, sort of the estimated cost to open a 1,250 square foot office. So we've got a total here of about 350,000, but maybe I'll ask Frank if you could maybe expand a little bit, dive a little deeper on the leasehold, how much that typically runs on a per square foot basis.
Okay. On an office this size, you should budget, again, here in Ontario, you should budget, say, between $120 and $130 a foot. That should cover everything except medical stand, like equipment stands. Mm-hmm. It'll look after all your frame displays. It'll look after reception desk, basically the millwork. What the variables are, like what'll bring you from the 120 to the 130 is really the finishings. Like, what kind of flooring you're going to go with, what kind of laminates, even the concepts themselves, how detailed the millwork is. So cabinetry obviously is one of the biggest components, in determining, a cost. Now, again, if you're getting a location that is in, okay, I'll give you an example. You go downtown Toronto in one of the high rise. You get a ground floor in one of the high rise. You're going to encounter a lot of conditions, working conditions, that a contractor is gonna have to increase his price because of the demands that are made there, meaning that there's certain hours that you're going to be restricted to working in. You may be forced to use a lot of the base building contractors, which don't come cheap. They require more management, there's a lot more paperwork. So again, the price of 120 to 130 is a very general average. Okay. You could go a little bit cheaper, and you can go up. I would say, you know, we've built offices that you can get up to $150 a foot because of location and because, you know, the very, very fancy and very fancy selections in cabinetry and finishings.
Okay. Thanks, Frank. Michael, again, does this sort of costing that we've laid out here on the screen, does that kind of line with sort of the direction you're headed? I mean, I don't want to, you know, get too detailed on what you're spending, but does anything kind of stand out? Does this ring true?
I mean, I wonder at some point if there may be some differences in between contractor rates in Alberta and Ontario. It wouldn't surprise me one bit. Another thing that isn't the case with MySpace is it's about twice the size of this. So these are, it's hard to comment to give a totally honest answer, but the things that I've learned and thought of over this whole process, one key piece of advice I remember getting at the start was have a space that's big enough that you can grow into. And if you want to hire associates, make sure you can build out for that. So my practice actually has a few lanes, but I won't be using them, or I'd use one for storage, maybe in the hopes in a few years I could hire somebody. So these are things when you're starting you need to think about, but they're long-term plan type situations. Aside for that, this slide looks fairly accurate. So I think that these are all considerations that apply to me and would apply to any new startup.
Okay, thanks.
And Jeff, if I can weigh in another second.
Yeah, go ahead, Frank.
The one thing I did forget to mention too, when you're dealing with a size, you know, 1,200 square feet, there's certain things that you have to do for small spaces that it's the same thing for a large space. Okay, the biggest cost right now, other than millwork, are these barrier-free washrooms. And I have to make sure that everyone here in Ontario knows how serious it's become with barrier-free washrooms. Just the cost of the equipment to furnish a barrier-free washroom right now is over $7,000. That is just to buy the equipment. Then you have to hire someone to do the installation. This is audible alarms, automatic locking, unlocking, the power openers. And over and above that, the size that the washroom takes up now is something that you definitely have to take into consideration. Like when you're renting or buying a 1,000 foot or 1,200 feet or 1,300 feet, a big chunk of that space, when you're going for a brand new application, meaning that if it's a minor renovation that you can get away with not applying for permit, then you're fine. But if you have to apply for permit, that means that if you're putting up any kind of walls, that you have to relocate sprinkler systems or make an adjustment on the plumbing. Not necessarily the electrical, because ESA here in Ontario really doesn't speak to the building departments. Okay, so if it's just electrical, usually you can kind of get away with it. But anytime that you have to apply for a building permit, you will have to upgrade the facility to accommodate for barrier-free. Okay, again, this past year, the size has increased again for the size of the washroom. Okay, so you can easily plan on a washroom anywhere between 8x10, 8x11, 9x11, okay, depending on how your entry point is to the washroom. So these are substantial, you know, takes a big chunk out of your space and your budget.
Right. That's very good to know. I mean, I'm sure if it's not the same in other provinces, it probably soon will be. So thanks for adding that. Question to the group. Are there areas where you think you could save money on this list, and areas where you definitely should not cut corners? So just opening it up to the group and see areas where you can maybe save a little money or areas where you should not save money. In fact, you might want to spend even more.
I think I can speak to that a little bit. When I opened my budget, my total budget was what you have listed for the leaseholds. So it was pretty tight. And I think somebody gave me very good advice to start, you know, with the equipment that you have, not necessarily that you need, not necessarily that you just want to have. So I did not have an autorefractor, for example, to begin with. I had a lensometer. So there's a few pieces of equipment that I was unable to purchase that we have added since. And I also think that in terms of design, I was able to save some money, not necessarily on using big part of the budget on the millwork or some of the design features that we were able to build ourselves for a fraction of the cost, for example, from IKEA. They're still holding up, hopefully until we have to move. So I think there's places where you cut down on some costs there.
Okay. Anyone else have anything to add on that point?
Ritesh Patel again. I get this point. And Frank mentioned it as well. Millwork. I don't think the sticker shock of millwork hit me until we actually got to the process. Millwork is really expensive. Michael, I'm sure you can speak to that as well. So I mean that cost is what it is. In many cases, I think I did something amazing in terms of being able to cut it down a little bit there. Where I think that where I would be okay with investing money is in equipment that especially the patients are going to see. So, you know, we were in a very similar fashion in line with what you have listed here in terms of the estimated cost. But I wasn't really afraid of investing in things like a retinal imager, anterior sight camera, things such as along those lines that a digital phoropter, for example. Now, can you do without all those things? Absolutely. But what I found was that, you know, all those, at least those three things specifically for me were practice builders. So, you know, when you're looking at it as a point where like, oh my God, I'm in, you know, debt if you're going to be in debt, or you're taking a loan if you're going to take a loan. But if you look at it as an investment in terms of what's going to allow you to not just make that that financial or make that growth back, but make it back faster, then don't be afraid of taking that risk, because you'll find out very shortly that it's not as it may not be as big of a risk as you may have thought of initially. So, you know, we were fortunate enough to invest in things like a anterior sight camera, a slit lamp camera, from day one. And it was expensive, but it was probably one of the best ROIs I had from the beginning. So, you know, looking for things such as that, I think, can really play a key role in terms of your success.
Okay. Thanks, Ritesh. So I think we'll move on to the next slide.
And once you've built your practice, you now want to create your brand and market your practice. Lori, how did you come up with your practice brand identity, your color schemes, your logos, all that sort of thing?
I actually started the whole process, even before I found a location, by meeting with my graphic designer. And when I had met with her, I already had my whole concept in place. I knew the concept that I wanted my practice to be. You know, I had an idea of the type of exams we would give. I knew we wanted to be around wellness and holistic. And I just talked to her and I explained to her everything. And I actually even already set my core values, because I thought everything was going to be based around this. And from there, she came up with some concepts. Like, she came up with some designs, because I love beautiful things, but I can't design anything myself. And we built out, and I have a great graphic designer, and we worked together, and I really wanted something to be consistent throughout. So she created a whole package for me, from our logo to, you know, we decided I wanted to do a service menu with all our services, like you would get in a spa. And to get a lot of those ideas, I visited spas and, you know, just so many different businesses, and kept collecting everything. And I sat with her and said, this is what I like. This is what I want to create. This is how I want people to feel when they come into the practice. And she came up with a great package. And it's actually, that's the package that I took when I met with my designer to design the space. And so a big thing was to make it cohesive. And I haven't looked back. We go to those designs for everything. So I think that was very important.
Sounds like you did just the right thing. Now, Laura, you've done some unique things to bring patients into your new practice. Can you share some of those with the group?
Well, I've got to say, one of my biggest things throughout this whole process has been marketing. I mean, and Tina, I must have asked you and Jeff and Howard, like all my biggest questions are about how do you market? How do you market? Because everybody says, has great ideas, but then they say it's trial and error. And it's hard when you don't have a budget, but you have to spend money on something to do trial and error. So we had to be very creative. And one of the things we did early on is because we had a big space, especially where our retail boutique was, is we actually partnered with a yoga instructor and we had yoga in our space. And we started by doing Saturday morning. We offered $5 yoga. I actually didn't even take any money for it. I just used it as I offered a free space for the instructor and we marketed it and it brought people in. And then it grew a little bit. She actually did a few more classes during the weeks for a few months and it went on for about a year. And I have to say that we still get patients that come because they used to do yoga.
Oh, excellent. Richesh, now that you're in 4 years, what do you do to market your practice today?
You know, it's pretty incredible to see how marketing has changed, even in just the 4 years that that we've been in practice. Of course, one of the major ways to be able to kind of reach out to people and really do it on a no-cost budget would be through social media. And that's been a strong point for us and what we put an emphasis on from essentially from before day one, for that matter. We still continue to do that this many years into the practice because, you know, as Lori said, you have budgets for things like print and postcards and so forth, and you quickly realize that your ROI on that on those may not be as high as it could be on versus something that's essentially free. So we really tend to, because we practice in a millennial-ish type of neighborhood, being able to kind of reach out to that type of demographic through things such as Instagram and Facebook, as well as Google, is a pretty big part of our practice. Secondly, being able to leverage your patients that you have grown, you know, in the last 2, 3, or 4 years, I think is a crucial part as well, right? So allowing yourself, whether it's through automated systems or personalized systems, that allow you to keep in touch with your patients so that not only will that patient you've seen 1 or 2 or 3 years ago come back and see you, but you know what? If you've gained what you would want for them in terms of their care and their care is in line with what your philosophies are, you would hope to think at that point that their boyfriend, girlfriend, spouse, partner, kids, and so forth would be people that you'd see along the way as well. So, you know, your ROI is very much able to be leveraged through being able to reach out to your current patients and leverage it from there.
Excellent. Now, this is a question to the group. Does anyone have any effective marketing strategies to share that have not been mentioned? Does anyone use referral programs? Are no comments there?
Tina, Howard Dolman.
All right, here.
You know, one of the things that I have the honor of teaching the third year practice management course at the University of Waterloo Optometry School, and one of the things that I learned early on that I share with the students is that don't miss the opportunity at the end of the exam to ask your patients, your new patients, to refer their friends and family. As a startup clinic, every single person you see will be a new patient to you. And many of them will remark at the end that it's one of the most engaging and thorough eye exams they've ever had, because that's the energy you're going to put into your eye exams. It's going to make a difference to them. And so, you know, take the moment and explain to them that, listen, you want to share this care not only with them, but with their friends and family, and they're more than welcome to refer them.
Thank you, Howard. Just one tip. Practice management groups often tell us that we should be spending 2-4% of gross on marketing. And since you have no revenue in the beginning, how much do you think you should budget for marketing for a startup? Of course, there's no correct answer, but I will say that the more you spend at this particular time, the greater the payout's going to be overall. So one bit of advice is to try as much as you can to front-end load your spend to get as many patients in the door in the beginning so that you can start generating that word of mouth momentum.
So In running your practice, you're going to have a number of supplier decisions to make. And to help us with this process, Christina from CIMI will help us answer the following question. So, Christina, how many frames should a new practice have on their board? How many vendors should a new practice deal with? And then how do you come up with the product mix?
Sure. So there's no exact magic number as to how many frames you should have, because really that does depend on your space and the setup of the gallery in your practice. So whether you have rods on your boards or if there's shelves, because shelves are wonderful. They can mask gaps and they can give an illusion of having more frames. You can load up shelving with POP materials, so you don't have to have every square inch loaded with a frame. But I would say that about 400 to 500 frames is probably the right number. And then 100 more for each additional full-time doctor. So if you are going to have three full-time doctors running in the practice, then you know we should have about 800 pieces on the board. Okay. The number of vendors or how many vendors you should have, that's probably not the right question, but rather how many collections should you carry?
Right.
So yeah, I would recommend no more than 15 collections, because then it starts to get a little bit out of control. It's a lot to manage. And instead, really sink your teeth into a collection. So have a really good presence for each of the brands, and don't be afraid to go deep into the colors. So I think it'd be better to have all the best-selling models on your board and have more colors of each of those models than to have a lot of different styles, half of which probably don't sell through. And your reps, they are the best people to help you with this, because they know their product better than anyone. So once you've decided what your target market is going to be, then you want to find the product and the styling, of course, that matches the needs of that market. And you know, sometimes it is a little bit of trial and error. You set it up as best as you can. You may not get it totally right from the start, but with close inventory monitoring and consistent management, you will be able to tweak it and get it right pretty quickly.
That's a great point around vendors versus product lines. So thank you for going over what that difference is. I think it's an important one.
Sure.
So we'll switch gears and maybe pick your brain a little bit with respect to an EMR system. What should people be considering? And I think the biggest thing that people debate with in the beginning is, should they go with a cloud-based system or one that is based in the practice of the servers within the office?
Mm-hmm. And the choice of software, it is so important. Your software actually dictates the processes that you will be using in your office, and it impacts how those processes are carried out on a day-to-day basis. So I would say definitely today, our EMR systems that are cloud-based, they are more popular instead of a server-based program. And I think one of the main reasons for that is because of all the integrated patient communication capabilities that are allowed. So things like texting your patients their appointment confirmations and having fully integrated online booking. So meaning your patients can go on to your website and book an appointment right through directly into your schedule, not that you need to have a subsidiary program or a third-party program that piggybacks onto your program. It's fully integrated, completely seamless. And we really know that today this is the way that consumers want to communicate with you. So I think it's important to start adopting this type of technology. I mean, the other beautiful thing is we're also used to Google and Google sharing and sharing our calendars. I couldn't imagine dealing with a calendar that is static and that we can't access through the web. You could manage your calendar from anywhere. So you have a snowstorm, and now your receptionist doesn't have to drive into the office. She can just log in from home and call the patients and tell them the power's out and that there's no appointments today. So those online communication capabilities are really key. I think the other thing that I would recommend is making sure to choose a software that can provide you with detailed sales reports and sales activities. So reports on every time you invoice something, whether it's service or products, and that allow you to drill down. So not just tell you how many frames you've sold, but which exact models. So without that kind of information, there's no way that you can make proper decisions. So all of the processes that happen in your office depend on your software. So it is definitely not something or a decision that you take lightly.
Okay. Maybe I'll just ask Michael quickly here. Not asking you which vendor you chose, but are you going to go cloud-based or server within your practice?
I am going to go cloud-based for my practice. As everything Christina said there, I've really come to enjoy the functionality of it. And I enjoy the opportunities for recall, text-based, and for accessibility. So these are all points that Christina touched on. But it's not like there aren't other advantages to the internal server-based methods, but I think the way of the future is online appointment bookings, and that's best achieved with some of the cloud-based versions.
Okay, great. So maybe we'll do poll number three. So David, if you can maybe pop up poll number three, and it's the question there is what best describes your outlook on setting up a practice? Hopefully we haven't scared you off with the talk, but hopefully we've encouraged you, I should say.
Okay, so we'll hit the next topic, which is staffing. Perhaps one of the most challenging aspects of starting a practice and of running an existing practice is staffing. Agata, what did you look for when you hired your first one or two employees, and how did you find them?
My very first employee, I was looking for somebody who was comfortable seeing patients and somebody who was good face-to-face. And I think the first one I found through the Indeed website. So because our process had moved along so quickly, I don't think, honestly, I had enough time even to really wait and find just the right person. So my first hire worked out for a period of time, and then thankfully I had some other people walk through the door that have been really critical to the practice at this point. So that's one of the mistakes probably that I had also made, was not a lot of time left to find the right person.
Great point. Howard, in recognizing that there are regional disparities, can you give us an idea of what we should expect to pay for, say, A, a front-end staff, and B, a dispensing staff?
Sure, Tina. We make use of a company called PayScale, PayScale Human Capital, or PayScale.com, and they've been able to provide us with fairly specific information to allow us to know that we're paying our staff appropriately. And so for a front desk staff person, they'll give you from the 10th percentile right up to the 90th percentile and what the 50th percentile is. So for a front desk person, you're looking at anywhere from about $11.50 all the way up to over $20, depending on experience and the number of years they've been with your clinic, with the 50th percentile being a little over $15. And then for the optometric assistant, it's maybe a little more than that. So from about $13.50 up to $18.50, with about close to $16 being the 50th percentile. And just to give you an idea, because it is community-based, that would be for London, Ontario. So, a big small city or a small big city of about 350,000 people.
Okay. Now, Howard, I don't know if you can answer this question, but being mindful that you have budget constraints when you're opening, do you think it's better to go with a lower wage who has maybe less experience, or spend more on more experienced staff?
That's a great question, Tina. Honestly, I think when it comes to hiring, I think there's one card that trumps everything else, and that's the right person. If you have a person who just seems to carry the right attitude and the right energy and the right personality, and you know they're going to fit into your practice culture, even if they have zero experience in the ophthalmic or optical industry, you can train those skills, and they'll be worth paying a little bit more for. So you know, my experience has taught me to go with the right person.
Well, that's a great point, Howard. Now, this is a question for the group. Has anyone made mistakes in hiring? And I know Agata shared with us her thoughts, but has anyone else made mistakes? And or does anyone have any tips they want to share with us in terms of hiring?
It's Lori. I just want to share that one mistake I made is I hired based on skill rather than based on it being the right person and culture fit. And that was actually something that I hope I'll never do again because it actually made a big difference in the clinic. So my advice is, regardless how much skill they have and how much experience they have, you know, if your gut's telling you differently, I would go with your gut.
Sounds great. I guess one tip I can share here is that we do, I'll call it a pre-interview via phone or Skype before we actually bring someone in for an in-house interview. And in that pre-interview, we ask just a few questions. One is for the person to tell us a little something about themselves, and they choose whatever they're going to tell us. We ask why they're interested in working for us. We tell them what the hours are, and we ask them what their wage expectation is. And I found that with those four simple questions, we can get a good idea of whether or not we're both on the same page and whether or not I think their personality is going to fit with our office. And it does eliminate a good 50% of candidates right off the bat because either we're not on the same page or I can just tell right away that their personality is not going to fit with us. Okay.
So starting a practice can be overwhelming with the multitude of decisions that have to be researched and made. So to ease that burden, there are a number of practice management consultants, like Simi, for example, you can turn to. I recommend is not only one of the leading buying groups, but also a practice management group. So you've got management consultants like Simi, you've got buying groups like I Recommend. So maybe Howard, can you share what a buying/practice management group like I Recommend can offer startups?
Sure, Jeff. You know, When you look at starting your practice, you're faced with this daunting cost, and included in that cost is the equipment, the frames, everything that you're going to bring in to your clinic that goes above and beyond the millwork that's already very expensive, but well worth it. Let me put that in there. And so the first question I had when I was looking at buying groups is, well, what are the discounts? You know, how much am I going to save on frames, lenses, contact lenses, all the accessories? And what I quickly found is that there's not a huge difference between groups. There are some, but not a big difference. And so most groups will be able to provide you the buying power that you need, you know, from a group, which is much better than you'll get on your own. And you know, thank you for giving me the opportunity, but what I found with I Recommend is that the buying group is used as a mechanism to provide training. Not just for your staff in all areas of the office, front desk, pre-test, optical, but also for you as a business owner. And one of the best programs is a 4-day intensive training called OD Business, spending a day on finance, on marketing, on HR and operations. And so it really gives you the opportunity to build from the ground up your business skills as an optometrist owner.
Okay, thanks, Howard. As a seasoned practitioner, and I've been in practice for 24 years now, I can tell you that there are numerous times that I've attended a seminar, including this past weekend, where I've heard great ideas and thought, hey, when I get back to work on Monday, I should do that. 2 years later, that great idea is still on my to-do list. So that's where a company like Simi can become invaluable. They can act as a coach, a trainer to help you with the implementation phase. And I think that's where optometrists typically fall down is implementing that great idea. So maybe Christina, what are some things that Simi can do to help a startup in particular?
Oh, in a startup, we can help with anything from helping you with your business plan, finding you the list of suppliers to contact, all of the different resources, anything. We could manage everything, or we could only manage little parts of it. It would be completely up to the the doctor starting out. So, but similar to any of the other management consulting groups out there, I think the biggest and most important thing is to help lay the foundations for the right processes in the office. Because after we go away and we leave, then you've got to be able to function on your own and perform and produce effectively.
Okay, thanks so much, Christina. I guess we're short on time here, so this brings us to the end of our formal presentation. And it looks like we just have time for one question that I'll throw to the panel. And that is, if they can tell me what they feel they did that had the biggest impact on the success of their practice in these first few years. So Lori, can you let me know what your thoughts are?
What I think had the biggest impact was actually my planning, because before I even, you know, opened the clinic, I had everything completely planned out, from a procedure manual to everything we needed. And I found that became invaluable because I actually hit a roadblock, and 6 months into opening my practice, I had to go on medical leave. And it's been a rocky 2 years, but I always had that to fall back on. And without it, I just thank my lucky stars that I had the foresight. And I have to say that I had that foresight because I took OD business. And that OD business is something that I have decided to do every year. So planning, so important.
Thank you, Lori. And Agata, what would you say had the biggest impact on your success?
I would have to say choosing the right location. I think finding the neighborhood that you think suits you, sort of speaking back to what Ritesh said about being authentic and practicing in a place where you feel most comfortable, has been really a practice generator, because the patients walk in and it's, you know, we live here, we work here, we see them daily. And I think that's been a great thing for growing the practice.
Excellent. And Ritesh, what do you think had the biggest impact on your success?
You know, to the point of what both Lori and Agata said, I resonated with that as well. But I think being able to actually reach out to your colleagues, you know, I'm sure Jeff can attest to this. Actually, almost everybody in this panel can attest to this. Howard, we've had calls. Agata, as we've had meetings and calls, is realize that a lot of other practitioners and your colleagues are going through the same thing as you. So don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to let them know what you're going through and be able to lean on them for advice and insight. I've been very fortunate to be able to just ask. And, you know, I'm more than happy to help colleagues as are everybody else around you as well. Because, you know, at the end of the day, everybody wants you to be able to succeed, and that includes your colleagues. So being able to reach out to your own colleagues, I think, is a very important thing to be able to do and feel comfortable doing it.
I couldn't agree with you more, Ritesh. And in fact, that's one of the things I would say joining I Recommend has really helped with, is just that networking aspect.
Okay. Right. So thanks, everybody. Thank you so much for attending our Start Me Up webinar. A special thanks to our panelists who have been very generous with their time and their knowledge sharing. And of course, to our sponsors, I Recommend, Simi, and Urban Spaces. So please remember to visit iCareBusiness.ca and subscribe. That way you'll get updates on iCareBusiness and updates on future webinars. If anyone you know has missed tonight's webinar, they can listen to it on our website beginning Wednesday, October 18th. So thanks again, and have a great evening, everyone.